All right, so in session four, we're going to talk about this thing called attachment and detachment. Attachment sounds good, but we're not going to be talking about it like it's a yummy thing. And then we're going to talk about detachment, which I think sometimes has been misinterpreted to feel like something that's quite horrible. But I think it's really more about healthy living. So we're going to talk about these two concepts uniquely within the context of substance use disorder. And we're going to end up with talking about letting go and letting God. So let's get started with that. Remember, use the Q&A feature if you have any questions at any time. I love to be interrupted. Okay, so here is when we have disordered attachment. Disordered attachment is very, has some telltale signs. But you have to look for them because sometimes it just sounds like people just really love somebody a lot. And that's true. But when love goes awry and gets outside healthy parameters, then we get in trouble. So here are some of the signs and symptoms. Somebody who has become overly attached for really good reasons, because they're scared they're going to lose somebody, right? They're scared to death, and they really do love them, ends up hysterically anxious. There's one thing to be anxious about a situation. It's quite another to be hysterically anxious, because when we're in that mode, we're in fight, flee, or freeze mode. We're not making good decisions. It's when people become preoccupied with another person's problems and they begin to underfunction in their own life. They probably don't even know that they're doing it, but they're so distracted by thinking about what someone else is or is not doing, they begin to not quite be fully present at work. Maybe things aren't going so great in their marriage, but they don't really notice. Maybe they're not able to attend to the needs of their own children. In some of the videos you're going to watch or have watched at the NACR site, you'll see that there is conversation about that when James tells a story about how his little brother's grades began to drop because people weren't attending to him like they had before and what was healthy before. We become obsessed and controlling. And this is really... kind of living in the land of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. Because this obsession and controlling does nothing to change the situation. I've heard Juanita Ryan say before, for example, you can see her on the video on the website as well, that they were doing all sorts of taking turns watching over James, staying at home and managing their work schedule. And the only thing that did was disrupt their work schedule. James was still using. It's very reactionary. So it is the this kind of detachment is very crisis driven, and people can't seem to hold on to in their minds a strategic plan to follow through very faithfully and steadily and patiently. A person that is unhealthily detached is emotionally dependent. They feel more the other person's emotions than their own emotions. And then all the typical things we know of, caretaker, rescuer, enabler, all that stuff that we're firmly attaching ourselves to their need for us. That's unhealthy attachment. And it is often a way that we manage our own anxiety by trying to control their behavior. Let me say that again. Managing our own anxiety by trying to control someone else's behavior. I wonder if any of you can relate to that. I certainly can. So that's what unhealthy attachment looks like. It's, as Melody Beatty says, becoming overly involved and sometimes even helplessly entangled. Detachment, in contrast, is not detaching from the person whom we care about, but from the agony of involvement. Boy, we're really going to have to unpack this today. But I hope you can see me, and I'm going to give you a visual of the difference. There's a difference between detachment, which is leaning in. It's not no involvement. It is appropriate involvement based on responding with a strategic plan to a problem you have identified, and then you've done your best to say, what does the best practice tell us to do in this situation, right? That's leaning in with detachment. This is what we often call detachment. End-stage codependent withdrawal, where we just throw up our hands and say, I'm done. That's not detachment. You won't stay done. You'll just, let me give you an analogy. It's like being a crack addict. Okay, crack addicts that I'm friends with go into crack houses and they stay 3 or 4 days and use until they're so exhausted even they can't use anymore. They don't eat, they don't sleep, they just use, use, use. Then they crawl out on their hands and knees and beg somebody to come pick them up and take them home to rest. Okay, that's end stage crack using for that time, exhaustion. It's not a change in behavior when they stop. They're just going to go home and eat and rest and gather more money to go back, okay? And when we do this end-stage codependent withdrawal, it's because we've gotten so tired that we're just exhausted. And we stop the hysterical, anxious, controlling, obsessed, reactionary, and emotionally dependent behaviors for a short period of time. Now, this matters because if we're working or leading in recovery ministry or we're trying to self-evaluate, we need to be able to discern, am I just exhausted with end-stage codependent withdrawal or am I learning how to detach? And my big dream would be at the end of today, you'll have a few more tools to tell the difference. Okay, end-stage codependent withdrawal, right? We begin to, I'm going to show you some quotes that in a second to talk about it further. But one of the things that you often hear people talk about is how you have to allow the consequences to fall on the person who has earned them. That is getting it half right. That is absolutely true. We begin to let natural consequences for natural behaviors, we stop getting in the middle of that and interrupting it. When we're teaching these points to someone, when we're ministering to someone, or when we're trying to evaluate ourselves, this is a pretty difficult thing to discern without a tribe of people to help us understand how to do that. We just don't quite know how to get out of our own way. It's counterintuitive. It doesn't feel logical, and we really need help and support in figuring out how to get out of the way of natural consequences. One example I would use is a mother who feels like she's gotten out of the way and detached by encouraging her son with outstanding warrants to turn himself in to jail, which he does. And then the whole time he's there, she's calling various lawyers, trying to strategize on his behalf and convince lawyers to take his case. That's half wrong, right? So we need to be careful, and there's some nuance to that. One of the things that end-stage codependent withdrawal does, remember, kind of jazz hands, is it leaves us with this feeling that our only option is to do nothing but wait. And that's dangerous. And I don't know, guys. I kind of think it's wrong. Nothing, I believe, gives addiction an open invitation to continue its destructive ways. Nothing is, in my mind, a dangerous misuse of detachment. So detachment is not just getting exhausted and withdrawing because we're just so hurt and angry and downright resentful and hostile. Detachment is not resigned, despairing acceptance. That's where you just are like, there's nothing I can do. There's usually something we can be doing. Detachment is not the same thing as having an attachment disorder, i.e., being a person who is unable to be healthily attached and form intimate relationships. So this is something that we're looking for in ourselves and others to see if maybe detachment is really getting confused with something else altogether. And detachment is not fantasy living, right? So it's not making up a story about how now that you're detached, you know, you're objective all the time, that you're not upset, that you're not anxious or distressed. That's not true. When you have a loved one with a substance use disorder, you are going to be anxious. That you can be honest about that. Detachment isn't neat and clean and lovely. It's messy, chaotic, and sometimes it feels like a fight to the finish. Detachment is not severing healthy relationships. So we need to be on the alert when we are dropping down and getting more unhealthy of distancing ourselves from healthy relationships, and look out on that for the part of other people as well that you are ministering to. And detachment is not shirking our responsibilities. So here's an example. You have a 19-year-old in the throes of a substance use disorder, and you decide that detachment is necessary. I would still pay his health insurance, right? Or her health insurance. I'd pay that. What I might not be willing to continue to pay is a cell phone, or provide him a car, or put gas in the car that you've already provided. It's really interesting how hard it is to decide what to do and not to do when we are consciously seeking to detach. And we forget so easily what's normative and what the end game is. And we just get sucked in to details that are kind of messy. As substance use disorder progresses in a family, and say the 19-year-old has now turned into a 30-year-old, detachment would be learning how to ask the question, would I be doing this for a 30-year-old who doesn't have substance use disorder? And what things do I have to do for safety's sake? Because I have a 30-year-old with substance use disorder. It's very easy to forget what normative behavior looks like, and it's very easy to lose sight of the fact and not notice that what we're doing in our obsessing reactionary mode is not producing any change. That's a warning sign to us. And we're going to talk in a minute about what kind of change we might expect. But okay, let's talk just for a second about how we can begin to move from dependent attachment to supportive detachment. Dependent attachment often means that we forget to pop out of someone else's fantasy lifestyle. So at this point, and this is where these wonderful internal boundaries can come in, we can be the kind of people who are really trying to stay true to what our core values are, even in the midst of dealing with someone with a substance use disorder. So I, for one, consider it kind of a value of mine to stay attached to reality. I grew up in a family system where reality really wasn't considered, you know, mandatory. There was a lot of fantasy living in my dysfunctional family system, a lot of grandiose thinking, big plans, low follow through, jumping from one next big dream to the next without attending to the small daily tasks of living and relating well within our family. So it is really important for me and for many family members who have a family system that has dealt with some sort of dysfunction or instability to begin to be increasingly conscious of what fantasy living is versus living in reality. So one of the things that somebody might say is, my daughter doesn't have a job because, you know, she's a starving artist. Or my son is just so creative, he just can't work well with others. And in point of fact, they may be creative and they may be starving and they may even be artistic. But the facts are this. They're at such a stage in their substance use disorder that they can't show up for work on time, or they can't complete a job assignment. And that's what's keeping them from getting a job. This is very confusing for families who've gotten sort of sucked into Alice in Wonderland's rabbit hole of sort of the convincing language of the substance use disordered person who is having trouble themselves staying in touch with what their reality is. Denial is a real thing, and it's very, very hard to combat without a lot of support. But let's move on and talk about how we support detachment. Traditional views of detachment focus on the concept, as rightfully as they should, of self-care, for example. But I'm not sure that self-care is applied necessarily in the way it needs to be. So let me give you some suggestions for that. I have friends who like to say, I did self-care. I went and got a mani-pedi. Now look, I'm a big fan of mani-pedis. Totally big fan. I think we should all have. Men, women, children, I think they're fantastic. But that's not really what detached self-care is talking about. When we talk about supporting detachment and self-care, it's sort of like that Galatians 6 passage we looked at last week, where it says every person needs to carry their own load. And I gave the example of, you know, you carry your own backpack of responsibility. It is good self-care to not let other people's crisis interrupt your routine and schedule for paying your bills on time, going to work, preparing nutritious food for yourself, remembering to eat, or for some of us who eat when we're stressed, remembering to only eat when we're hungry. Self-care is taking good care of the bodies we have without obsessing about how someone else is taking care of their bodies. Self-care is learning how to take responsibility for our life, to live the life that our core values, here we go, lead to expression through interior boundaries, which result in behaviors. So, for example, I happen to be a big proponent of believing that unhealthy people are not helpful in helping substance use disordered folks get better. So I think it's really important to be super healthy. I think I need to sleep 8 hours a night. I need to exercise every day. I need to be having an eating plan that is healthy for me. I need to have my prayer and meditation time every day. I need to work my full-time job in the hours that I need to get it done in. I need to be present for others. I need to be present for my family. I need to be present for me, all under this foundation of this awareness of these relationships is how I express love for God, love for others, and love for self, my ultimate core value, living this greatest commandment that Jesus gave us to live. When we're doing all those things, notice what we don't have time for. We don't have time for endless conversations on the phone to talk about what cousin Gary did or didn't do. We don't have time for ruminating because we're moving on to the next thing that we need to do. We don't have time for endless hours of searching somebody else's room for what they may or may not have in there. Self-care is a full-time job with space to be able to help carry other people's burdens when that's an appropriate thing to do. We don't carry everybody's burdens. We carry the people's burdens for whom it makes sense that we're helpful to in that way. Supporting detachment means that we need to let go of control, and that often means releasing expectations of particular outcomes. It's very difficult to do. I don't think we can do it at all unless we are doing a reasonable job of self-care, where the only expectations we're having primarily are for ourselves, not other people. Again, with good self-care, letting go of our need to control, allowing other people to choose their own adventures, minding our own business first and foremost, finding our place of peace, all good self-care stuff. We're using that, got the internal boundaries, have the outward look on life, and we're saying, now, how am I going to interface with other people in the world? That's how we support detachment. It's very important work. Can I go back just for a second to this idea of letting go of our need to control? This is something we could unpack for hours, but let me give you one example to sort of stimulate your thinking about all the ways that we haven't thought about this applying. One of the most common things that somebody says to Scott and I when we have an initial contact with someone from the community. So just to be clear, Scott and I co-pastor North Star Community in Richmond, Virginia, which is a very small, humble recovery church. And it's got a reputation around the Richmond area for being helpful as a community mission for resourcing and supporting the work of our greater community at large, for helping people, family members, and substance use sufferers get resourced, leveraged help to get where they need to go. Okay, so that's our background. So we get a lot of cold calls of families that have been referred by somebody who referred them by somebody, you know, 3-4 phone calls later, somebody calls us. Our job titles are pastors. And often people lead with this statement, we are Christians and our kid is a Christian. Okay. And I'm going to ask them at some point to detach that identity and all the expectations that they have placed on themselves for that with dealing with the nature of the affliction of substance use disorder. I might make an analogy to them that says, when you think you're a diabetic and you call an endocrinologist, do you lead with the statement that you are a Christian? You don't, do you? See, I believe that there is a huge place for spirituality in the recovery process, but I have seen enough to make me be concerned when we somehow shame ourselves to believe that good Christians shouldn't have this problem, or that being a good Christian somehow means that the solution to the problem is going to be different for you because of that. It's tricky, but I think it's an expectation thing and a shame thing, and I think it's just important to think about. All right. So here's an example of a quote that Deborah J. used in her book, No More Letting Go. So in this quote, this is someone giving advice to someone who loves someone with a substance use disorder. Okay. My dear, I'm so sorry you're facing this terrible situation. Unfortunately, he has to want help before anything will change. Not necessarily true. This is a myth. We talked about it in the first or second week of this class. That's not true. We do have a saying, when opportunity decreases, willingness increases. There are things we can do to make it more clear to our beloved that something is going to need to change. And he needs to think about how he wants to participate in that. And that's irrelevant to whether or not he wants help. It's positioning ourselves through the good skills of internal boundaries and detachment, with some skills we're going to be talking about next week in intervention, where we begin to say, I'm not asking you if you want help, because I understand that your brain thinks you need this to survive. That's an unfair question to ask. But what I do want you to know is that things are going to change, because I'm changing my approach and my my relationship with your disease. Not with my love for you, but with your disease. The best way you can help him is through detachment. Yes, when properly applied. You've got to let go. Okay, maybe. But there are also 20 other things you can do that don't involve letting go, that maybe you haven't thought of because you're hysterically anxious. And maybe if someone helped you with more vocabulary, more education, more options, more intervention material, then maybe letting go wouldn't even be necessary. It would just be rearranging the way the relationship is working. Stop rescuing him. Okay, yes, that's true. But we need never to tell anyone that when they don't even know that's what they're doing. People don't know they're rescuing. Remember, they've fallen down Alice's magical hole. What used to be not normal is now normal. So instead of telling somebody to stop doing something that they can't even differentiate between, maybe talk about what are some things that maybe you could do this week and some things that maybe you could stop doing. Real concrete, real practical. Let the cards fall where they may. Well, that's the old language. And I got to tell you, with the epidemic of opiate addiction and the entrance of fentanyl on the market, I don't think we have the luxury of letting cards fall where they may anymore. We just don't. So I think we have to be more proactive than that. You have to let him experience the pain of his own making. Let's let him experience the consequences of his own action, but let's understand that by the time somebody is in the throes of the end stages of a substance use disorder, can we all agree nobody asked for this pain? It was an unfortunate byproduct of becoming dependent on a substance that they never thought they'd become dependent upon, or in many cases, were prescribed by a physician. If you clean up his messes for him, he has no reason to get sober. Not cleaning up his messes is not what gets him sober. It's understanding that something's got to change, and he or she comes to see that that change is going to involve treatment. The messes aren't the magic, right? But cleaning up his messes for him is a problem. It's just not that one-on-one causation. When you detach from his problem, you force him to face the consequences of his addiction. Well, maybe, eventually. So we do want to detach from being involved in being the sole keeper of trying to solve his problem. But this goes back to that control thing. We can't really force anybody to face anything. And this is, as you all so well know, probably a life and death fight. Here's a few questions to ask yourself to consider an alternative perspective. Is motivating an SUD sufferer to get sober the same as forcing someone to do what they do not want to do? See, there's a big argument at, remember, jazz hands, end-stage codependent withdrawal. There's a big argument that somebody has to want to get sober. I've never known anybody that wanted to get sober. I mean, maybe there were some exceptions. But what they want in the throes is to not feel so lousy. They're not thinking about whether or not they want to be sober. They're thinking they just don't want to feel so bad anymore. It's like asking a really, really sick person, hey, do you want to train for a marathon? Right? Again, it's not really about forcing someone to do what they do not want to do, because many people do want to be relieved of the addiction. It's something entirely. Is freedom to choose an option for the SUD sufferer? A little bit. Yes, there are some choices that can be made, but I want you to just remember that that substance use disorder is a cunning, baffling, thing. And it's pretty compelling craving, and we have to respect that when we're thinking about what treatment means. What are the odds that we can find peace when immersed in the daily doings of addiction? So I want to be realistic about what we mean when we talk about detachment. Detachment isn't the get out of misery free card. Detachment is actually a skill set that increases the odds that we can support getting someone into recovery. It can't be an expectation. It's not a guarantee, but it's a skill set that supports that. But I know, and you know, that if there's someone you love that's in the throes of a substance use disorder, you are going to have some continual anxiety and some trauma and stress related to that, that you just learning how to get detached isn't going to solve. So let's be realistic about that. Reacting to trauma and perceived danger is natural. Remember those three things that our midbrain does. It wants to fight, it wants to flee, it wants to freeze. But it is unhelpful in the fight for recovery. So what we are trying to do is cooperate with the way our bodies, minds, and spirits work. Find a broader foundation for trust, just as we're going to ask the SUD sufferer to do in the first three steps of the 12 steps, where we are moving away from this worst case scenario planning, this overarching dread, this need to react and rescue, this hysterical anxiety, because we love this person enough to do the work we need to do in order to be helpful. That's why we detach. Not to make ourselves feel better, but to give ourselves a skill set so that we've put things in place so that we're not so traumatized all the time. This is why for me, a daily quiet time, meditation, prayer, getting outside, exercise, decent nutrition, all these things are crucial for me in terms of sustainability, in terms of being involved in recovery ministry. Very important work. Detaching does not mean that we do not care. It means we learn, and I love this so, so much, we learn to love, care, and be involved without going crazy. We stop creating all this chaos in our minds and environments. We stop creating all this chaos in our minds and environments. All right, so Molly Wolf has said this, and I think this is not a bad paragraph to try to move into personally. The healthy people I know seem to allow themselves to be less than fully certain without being paralyzed. So detachment means we know we're not going to get it perfect, or we're not even going to get it right all the time. We've jettisoned that standard for ourselves, but we are looking to do the next right thing based on what we know today. And she says they are able to be less than fully certain without being paralyzed. So they're taking actions and they're making decisions. They're honest about having their fears. That was my point earlier. Detachment doesn't make you fearless. It just makes you better equipped. They also face into them without running away. They lean into the fear. If you're afraid of what your kid's doing when they're using Kratom, you've got a couple of choices. My kid's using Kratom. Huh. Well, you know, I looked it up and it's not illegal in my state, so it's not a problem. Or you could look further and say, well, it is actually illegal in 6 states of the 50. And there's a huge amount of concern about using it because you can't regulate the dosage. And when somebody's mixing it, because this isn't being mixed in a pharmacy, you don't know what you're going to get with it. Kratom, for those of you who don't know, is a herbal supplement that people are ordering from overseas to try to manage withdrawal from opiate addiction. So if you have fears, lean into them and get educated. But don't think we're not going to be afraid, because this is scary stuff. Here you go. Here's what happens next with these healthy people. They debate within themselves and with others the right course of conduct, neither jumping for the simple answer nor being frozen into inaction. So we all know how it is. So many people, very reactionary, are doing lots of things without consulting anyone else, getting kind of stuck in their head. They haven't got the easy answers, but they're willing to go ahead as best they can. And then I love this. They are prepared to put a lot of effort and pain into making decisions while paradoxically trusting that in God's hands and in God's time, it will all come round right. That's a lot right there. And I think that's a great description of detachment. Detachment is not a wall. That's end-stage codependent withdrawal. That's a wall. Detachment is a bridge to make for more effective communication when dealing with a substance use disorder, or, as we said earlier, other dysfunctional issues that plague a family, like mental health issues. I love this so much. Detachment is a willingness to take action while knowing you cannot guarantee the results. The advice we used to give families 10 years ago has changed a lot in the last 10 years. That should pull us up by our bootstraps and make us alert and pay attention, right? Because we can only take action with the best practices and the best information we have today. But we know it doesn't guarantee results. And we also know that we want to improve the results we're having. So we're going to keep looking for new ways to do things and not hold on too tightly to the old ways just because they worked once in a while. We want to improve our serve here and be more effective in our help. We really need to do it, right? Okay, Kathleen Norris has this quote. She's talking about detachment as not being passive nor remote, but it's being fully engaged with the world. It goes back to those internal boundaries again. Engaged with the world, and we know what our limitations are, but we also know what our big dreams are. And so these internal values, internal core values, are going to drive some of the decisions we make. Don't let our decisions be driven by how someone else is acting. Let our decisions be driven by the kind of life we want to have, and invite other people to participate in life with us being the person we want to be. Do you really want to be the person that's following your kid when they leave in the car? Or you go through their backpack every time they go to use the bathroom? Right? Do you really want to encourage that behavior in someone else? Is this who we want to be? Do we really want to try to coerce people into believing that redoubling their spiritual disciplines is going to automatically result in freedom from addiction? that has not proven to be true. So we shouldn't be saying that. The detachment is freeing oneself from the preconceived ideas that influence action. In other words, and Scott, I think you would agree with me on this, right? That there are so many folks that come into us with a lot of preconceived ideas. I raised one earlier. My kid is a good Christian. They couldn't possibly have a problem, right? Look, I get good Christian moms who teach in preschools or are nurses or lawyers or serve on the stewardship committee at their church who call me and say, I really need to stop using opiates and I don't know how to stop and still function. So we've had a lot of preconceived ideas about substance use disorder being tied to being a person who is somehow intrinsically flawed or has a bad character. And that's not true. We have preconceived ideas that somehow being a, quote, good Christian should somehow provide a magic shield. Not true. And so these preconceived ideas can slow our reaction time and reduce our effective reaction. So Deborah goes on to suggest that when we pair compassion and objectivity, we end up with some clarity of insight, and it allows us to relieve suffering of others while simultaneously preserving dignity and justice. See, here's the problem. When we have preconceived ideas, then we also have preconceived expectations and desired outcomes. So if you think, let me be really personal. We raised our three children until we started this recovery ministry. We raised our three children in a large Southern Baptist church. I know about preconceived ideas. This implicit bias that if somehow we do all the good Christian things, bad things won't happen to us. That's not true. And getting stuck or confused in that just slows us down from getting the help we really need. All right. There you go. That's what I was talking about. Now, let's go on to the extreme perspective that is sometimes necessary when it comes to detachment. This is advice from the CRAFT program, which is a recovery program, kind of an alternative to the 12-step movement. And they are suggesting that there are some times when needed detachment means one must, for example, have a spouse must move towards ending the relationship with them. These things happen. This is sometimes the outcome, and we wouldn't want to say that never happens. But there's another perspective, and I know I'm getting to the end of my time. So I want to leave you with this, and then you can look at the rest of the slides. They're pretty self-explanatory. Here's the alternative to just ending the relationship. Now, sometimes you end the relationship from a place of detachment. But here's a thing to think about. Consider the fact that your alcoholic may need a little more organization and structure for intervention. So we could be thinking about that even in our own ministries when we're working with people. Maybe what we're doing, maybe we need to provide more structure, more education, more organization for how we intervene and provide support. There are many people who are teetering towards recovery and just a little push in the right direction with some concrete answers, alternatives, even brochures and pamphlets about treatment options. And then Deborah gives this kind of cautionary tale. She says, giving up doesn't always end the problem. A wife can divorce her husband, but the kids still have an addicted dad, and he might even get weekend visitations. So I think the point Deborah's making is end-stage codependent withdrawal is not without its own problem. So why don't we see if we can figure out how to detach with love, up our skill set for intervention, and try to provide the support people need, who, when they are at the end stage, are pretty desperate. They just don't know what they're desperate for.